On Wednesday, he again found Sam Matheson in his room at the Intercontinental. There were heavy rings beneath his eyes, sunburn across his forehead and cheeks, and Nabil wondered if the cross-country race had taken a serious toll on him. He'd verified that a man named Sam Wallace had registered and that his car had come in 11th among 38 participants. According to the records, he'd originally signed on with a partner, one Saeed Maurit, but Maurit had been dropped before the race began. He gave no sign that he knew Matheson's real name, only suggested that they continue their conversation in the street.
"Too claustrophobic?" asked Sam.
"Exactly."
In the nearby city market, they walked on packed earth among the crowds and vendors hiding under umbrellas. Nabil quietly said,
"Mr. Matheson, I know who you work for."
To his credit, the American didn't slow his step. Above, the blazing sun made his sunburn look all the worse. A nonchalant grin remained plastered to his face, and he shrugged.
"Who do I work for?"
"The CIA."
"My assumption was that if I'd told you, you wouldn't have accepted the deal."
"You were right."
Beside a table piled high with overpriced fabrics, he turned to face Nabil. He was a few inches shorter, but the confidence in his movements made him seem taller than he was.
"The offer's the same, Nabil. Those pirates are a public menace. They're screwing with business. We're getting pressured from all sides to get any kind of intel we can."
"Even from people like us?"
Sam waved that off.
"Your group's new. No one knows about you. In a few years, maybe we'll pay the pirates for intel on you. It all depends on what our masters ask for."
"This is something we have in common,"
Nabil said as he gazed at the intelligence agent who had suddenly opened himself up in a way that he would never have done. It was almost suicidal. What he'd expected was a denial and then a quick withdrawal. Perhaps even this had been calculated by Rome. Or perhaps, he thought suddenly, Ansar al-Islam had nothing to do with this, and it was precisely how the American presented it. The CIA just wanted some information. It was time to make a decision.
"And this man from the bank who's coming tomorrow?"
he asked.
"What is he?"
The smile faded from the American's lips before returning. It was a momentary lapse, less than a second, but Nabil didn't forget it. Sam said,
"His name's Paul Fisher. Yes, he's an agent too, but the money is real. After he's finished the transfer, you can do what you like to him."
"You want us to kill your colleague?"
"I didn't say that," Sam corrected. "It's up to you. Consider it a gift. If you like, you can claim responsibility and he'll be your first public execution."
"A videotaped beheading. Is that what you imagine?"
"It's not like you haven't done it before."
That was unexpected.
"Have I?"
Sam Matheson licked his lips. Nervousness? Or appetite?
"As I say, it's up to you."
It was only then that Nabil knew what to do. This man, whether or not he was from the CIA, had been sent by the Imam. Like the blinding sunlight pouring down on them, the realization fell upon him, and he knew. He was to kill a man named Paul Fisher. That was the Imam's desire. Why? Matheson was little help on this. Perhaps he didn't know.
"He's become a liability. We don't need him anymore."
Nabil turned toward Koinange Street, began walking, and reached into his pocket. He took out a pair of mirrored sunglasses and slipped them on, signaling Gedi and Dalmar.
"It's a remarkable gift. First money and then one of your own. I just wonder why the CIA would give him to us. It's not as if you couldn't get rid of him yourself."
"Despite what people say, the CIA prefers not to kill its own employees."
"You're very wicked, Sam."
Sam Matheson didn't answer. He seemed to consider the statement as they reached the street and the van drew up, its large door sliding open. Gedi and Dalmar jumped out and grabbed Matheson by the biceps and flung him inside. Nabil watched the door close again and the van jerk forward and swerve away. He watched it disappear into the afternoon traffic. As he walked back to his car, he rummaged through his pocket and came up with a pack of Winstons. He lit one and inhaled deeply. It was the first one he'd had in 3 days. He was doing well. When you're being watched, all your actions, however small, take on a presence of their own. Each has its own significance and its own variety of interpretations. You light a cigarette, and that might mean that you're nervous, you're relaxed, you've been co-opted by Western forms of decadence, or that you're desperately stopping time in order to invent your next lie. He had to stop thinking this way. If Ansar al-Islam was watching, the only important detail was the taking of Sam Matheson. They would know that Aslim Taslam left hesitation to those with less faith. Nabil took Sam Matheson's dry, surprisingly heavy hand from the table and dropped it back into the crumpled plastic bag, then slipped the bag into the pocket of his jacket as Kwambai fed Paul Fisher the lie.
Your suitcase, yes, full of clothes. You hadn't even unpacked. But no magical computer.
Nabil disagreed with this tactic, but Kwambai had been living with the doublespeak of politics for too long. He no longer knew how to be straight, and now he'd gone over the deep end. Yesterday's evidence had been irrefutable. Nabil had returned from the market, having stopped at a mosque along the way to offer his Asr prayer. After Sam Matheson, he'd felt the need for some community.
"He killed him," Getty said. "Kwambai killed the American."
Kwambai explained himself as they stood over Sam Matheson's corpse in the basement.
"He saw me. Your men brought him through the living room without a hood, and he saw me. I couldn't let him live."
Kwambai had put 2 bullets in Sam's chest and 1 through his neck. Sticky blood covered the floor, and the flies had already begun to swarm. Standing over him, the politician began to tremble all over. It was probably the first man he'd ever killed with his own hand. Kwambai said,
"His fingerprints. He said we'll need them for the computer."
"Why did he say that?"
"He thought it would save his life."
"So you had a conversation first?"
The politician seemed to have run out of words, so Nabil asked Getty and Dalmar to remove the American's hands while he took Kwambai outside and they looked for a spot to bury him among the low, dry trees in his backyard. Together, they dug a deep hole. Nabil stopped once, asked where East was, and kneeled in the dirt to offer his Maghrib prayer, while Kwambai ran into the house for more drink. By the time they finished, it was dark. All 4 men carried the body to the hole, and then Getty and Dalmar were given the unenviable task of cleaning the basement room. Over those later hours, as they filled the hole and stumbled back to the house, Kwambai's drunkenness faded and was replaced by a strange giddiness. He talked about the act he'd committed, the feel of the pistol, the kick of the bullet as it left the chamber, the American's stunned eyes that slowly lost their sheen. He described these things as a man describes his first time with a woman, with the pleasure of a wonderful thing newly discovered. The old politician had become a murderer, and he had enjoyed it. Afterward, the dynamic changed. Kwambai wanted nothing more than to be at the forefront of their operation. He quit mentioning money, only asked endless questions and offered suggestions for improvement, and when they brought in Paul Fisher, he was waiting in the basement to stare directly into his eyes. He no longer cared who saw him because he wanted to kill this one, too. Nabil had lost control of the operation. And now Kwambai was twisting the interrogation with his doublespeak and lies. The computer was sitting upstairs on the long oak table awaiting the codes and the fingerprint. All he had to do was ask Fisher to type in the code and they would all be 2 million euros richer. But Kwambai wanted to stretch this out, wanted to torture the American, and Nabil had no interest in watching it. So when Paul Fisher said,
"I don't believe you,"
Nabil gave a quick but crucial signal to Dalmar and Getty, walked out, and climbed the stairs to the living room. During the weeks since that bloody basement in Rome, he'd grown so tired of it all. He wondered when the light would begin to shine. People were not dying for the jihad, they were dying for the preparation for the jihad. For the bank accounts and the arms and the escapes from capture. One spent so much time dealing with the moment that the original dream, the one that made him cast away his fishing nets, seemed more distant than ever. How long could this go on? Even the Imam had asked him afterward if he still had the heart for the fight. For fighting, yes, always. But when you descend into a tenement basement in Rome and find two bruised, broken men tied up, facing a camera on a tripod, and then use a beautiful ceremonial sword to remove their heads, there is no battle rush, no visible battle won. Just a flooded floor, your body soaked in blood and sweat, and the ache in your arms from hacking with a blade better suited to adorning a wall. Daniel Kwambai's woody house was full of European furniture mixed with Kenyan folk kitsch. It was as uncomfortable as Kwambai himself. Nabil settled at the long table beneath an iron chandelier and opened the briefcase, running his fingers lightly over the keyboard and the flat screen, the things that offered entrance to a Swiss bank's deepest secrets. It was all still so strange to him. For a fisherman's son, none of this could ever feel comfortable. The computer, the narrow Vespa-buzzing streets of Rome, and the cacophony of Nairobi's taxi horns. The wily, now quite mad, political animal that was Daniel Kwambai. He felt more comfortable with those drunk ex-fishermen the world called pirates. He heard Kwambai climbing the steps slowly as the muted gunshots filled the house. The fat man paused, looked back, then continued. By the time he reached the end of the table, Getty and Dalmar had finished. It could happen so quickly.
"I thought they would wait," Kwambai said.
"I told them to do it as soon as you'd left the room. He'd been tortured enough."
"Torture?" Kwambai shook his head. "Perhaps you would have given him all the facts up front, Nabil? We know now that Benjamin Mwoki is working with them. But that's all we're going to get because you don't want the poor American feeling distraught."
Nabil shrugged.
"And what if the codes are fake?"
"I've considered that,"
Nabil said, because he had. If they lost 2 million euros, then so be it. He wasn't going to give this monster another happy murder. Kwambai turned the computer around, closer to himself, and sat down.
"Well, it's reckless. And with this much money, you can't afford to be reckless. You know what's going on here, and you have to think. That's what Rome expects of you. It's what I expect of you."
It was remarkable, really, how Kwambai was acting as if Aslim Taslam were his own fiefdom. But the politician was wrong. Nabil had been thinking for weeks. He'd been noting Kwambai's own reckless moves and raising each one to the light to see it better, pairing them up randomly to find connections. But only now, hearing his command to think, did a single thread of logic form to connect all the disparate clues. It was so perfectly simple that his hands became warm from embarrassment. He'd been thinking in the wrong direction. Do not confuse use with friendship.
"The hand?" said Kwambai.
A pause.
"What is it, Nabil?"
Nabil blinked but still couldn't see the old man well. He rooted around his jacket pocket and came up with the hand. He dropped it on the table. "Those who can help are welcome, but those whose help takes too much from us, those should be dealt with harshly." He heard the crackle of plastic as Kwambai took it out.
"This had better work,"
he heard the Kenyan say.
"This thing is foul. You smell it?"
"Disgusting,"
Nabil muttered as Kwambai powered up the computer.
"Where the hell am I supposed to scan the fingerprint?"
"Perhaps the Americans lied to you, Daniel."
An awkward pause.
"Perhaps."
From downstairs came the sound of Getty and Dalmar grunting, moving Paul Fisher's body around. Bodies everywhere. Yet here Nabil was, planning on one more as soon as the money had been transferred. Sam.
"They're inside,"
Natalia chirped through the radio in his ear. Sam leaned toward the apartment's high window, careful not to touch the tripod and shotgun mic, and gazed across Via del Corso at the mosque, the sound of car horns and buzzing Vespas rising through the heat to him. Ticklish sweat rolled down his back. From her position at an outdoor cafe, Natalia had a clear view of the entrance, while Sam could only see the upper window to the room where Saeed and Lorenzo would be taken once they'd introduced themselves to the imam. It was a tricky operation, enough so that a week ago, sweating in his temporary Republica apartment near the station, he'd suggested that Saeed leave town. The Moroccan had gotten up on his elbow, the light playing over his long olive body, and stared, a flash of anger in his thick brows.
"You think I can't do this?" "Of course you can. I've built up all the contacts. It's taken months. You know that." "I know. I'm just..."
"We shouldn't have gotten involved."
It was true, perhaps, but by now Sam couldn't quite imagine what life would look like without Saeed in it.
"Too late," he said, watching his lover's fleshy lips. "You want me to hide what I'm feeling?"
The Moroccan smiled.
"It's what we do. We should be good at it."
Seeing that the joke hadn't played well, Saeed kissed him and said officiously,
"Plenty of time, young man. We're still on for the rally?"
"Absolutely."
"You and me under the Kenyan stars again. We'll have plenty of time to figure out our future."
Which, Sam noted with satisfaction, was the first time Saeed had used that blessed word, future. So he'd gone over the operation 100 times more, adjusting details here and there, and even bringing in an extra agent to provide coverage inside. Paul Fisher, from Geneva.
"Paul," he said from his window perch, "you're there?"
"Si,"
came the whisper.
"Everything's smooth. Just keep doing what you're doing."
Though they'd known each other in the academy, it was a surprise to see Paul again. He was the most visibly nervous agent he'd ever dealt with. Sam even called Geneva to make sure that this was a man he could depend on. Fisher's top notch for his age was the reply, which told him nothing. While briefing Paul in his apartment, though, Sam had discovered a small P-83, a Polish gun, in Paul's jacket.
"Where'd this come from?"
"A Milanese, I know."
"Why?"
Paul shrugged.
"I like backup."
"Not on this job," he said, and put the gun in his desk drawer. "I'm not having you get them killed."
Paul had been sitting at the foot of the bed where Sam had last made love to Saeed. He hated this fidgety man touching those sheets. Paul said,
"I wasn't planning on using it."
"Then you don't need to carry it."
Paul nodded unsurely. While it had taken weeks to set up and could go wrong easily, the operation itself was simple. Lorenzo and Saeed were to visit the mosque and sit down with the imam in his study to discuss a Camorra arms shipment they had intercepted and wished to sell to like-minded people. From his post across the street, Sam would record the conversation. Natalia would watch the street for activity or reinforcements. Paul was to wait in the prayer hall to help facilitate any emergency escape. It took them a while to reach the imam's study. A body search would be de rigueur, as would an electronics sweep. In the far window, a light came on. A young man in a white skullcap pulled the thin curtains shut. Sam held one side of the headphones to his free ear, checked the levels against some language, perhaps Kurdish, being spoken in the room, and began to record. A total of 17 minutes passed before their arrival in the imam's chamber. During that time, Sam talked briefly with Natalia and listened to Paul mouthing the late afternoon Asr prayer with the congregation. Then a door opened in the room, and the imam greeted Saeed and Lorenzo in Arabic. For the benefit of Lorenzo, they switched to Italian. The proposal was on. In his other ear, Paul whispered,
"There's some activity."
"Problem?"
"Three guys breaking off prayer, talking."
"It's nothing."
"They're going to the stairs."
"How do they look?"
"Not happy."
Sam felt the old tension rising in his chest. The conversation with the imam was going well. They had moved on to the makes of the weapons. Paul said,
"They're gone."
"Stay there,"
Sam ordered.
"Shit."
"What?"
"Another one. He's looking at me."
"Because you're not praying. Now pray."
"That's not it."
"Ignore him and pray."
Silence. just the throb of voices speaking to their god.
Natalia?
All clear.
In his right ear, the imam mentioned a price. As planned, Lorenzo was trying to raise it. A knock on the imam's door stopped him. Someone came in. Arabic was spoken. Sam's grasp of the language was sketchy, but he knew enough to understand that they were discussing a suspicious worshipper in the prayer hall. According to the visitor, it was clear from the bulge in his pocket that he was carrying a pistol.
"You fucker," Sam said. "You brought your gun."
No reply.
"Stand up and walk out of there before you get them killed."
No reply.
"You better be walking."
No reply, just the sound of movement, a grunt, and then a single gunshot that thumped into Sam's eardrum. A pause, then Paul's wavering voice through the whine of his damaged left ear.
"Shit."
On the right, the imam's room had gone silent. Lorenzo said,
"What was that?"
Movement. Saeed.
"What are you doing?"
The imam, in Arabic,
"Get them out!"
More movement. Struggling. Natalia.
"Paul's out. He's running. Should I chase?"
A door in the imam's quarters slammed shut.
"Sam, what do I do?"
It wasn't until Thursday afternoon, 2 days later and a couple hours after he'd gotten the news, that he tracked Paul Fisher to a bar near the Colosseum, hunched in the back with a nearly empty bottle of red wine. Sam waited near the front, observing the shivering wreck of a man who was too drunk to see him. Behind Sam, two Italian men slapped on a poker machine, shouting at it, and he reconsidered the one thing he'd felt sure he would do once he found Paul Fisher. Though both had made a game of hiding their true feelings, he and Saeed had known from the start, when they were going about their various embassy duties in Nairobi, that they had found something unprecedented. Both had a broad enough sexual history, Sam in the Bay Area meat markets where you could be as open as you were moved to be, Saeed in the underground discos of Casablanca, but from their second night together they'd opened up more than they had with anyone else before. Perhaps, Saeed had suggested, they were like this because they knew that Sam was leaving for Rome in a month. Perhaps. But 6 months later, in Rome, Sam's phone rang. Saeed had wrangled a transfer and convinced his superiors that he should offer help to the Americans.
"This is a bed of liars,"
Saeed liked to say during their secret liaisons in what they started to call their Roman summer. But then he used that fantastical word, future, and Sam pounced on him with joyous descriptions of the Castro. Saeed was entranced, though he offered a counter-suggestion. Rio de Janeiro.
"Too hot," Sam told him.
"Northern California is too cold."
Now listening to the angry Italians and blip-bleep of the poker machine, Sam wondered what would have happened. Might they have bought a place in some high-rise along the Rio beaches? Or had their optimism been a symptom of the Roman summer, and in the end things would have gone the way of all his previous relationships? Nowhere. There was no way to know. Not anymore. Because of this drunk man in the corner. Kill Paul Fisher. Sam wasn't that kind of agent. He'd never actually committed murder, and until now he'd never wanted to. Yet as he approached the table he thought how easy it would be. How satisfying. Revenge, sure, but he began to think that Paul Fisher's death would be something good for the environment, the subtraction of an unwholesome element from the surface of the planet. Terrified, that was how Paul looked when he finally recognized him. Drunk and terrified. Sam sat down and said,
"We heard from the Carabinieri. Two bodies minus their heads were found in the Malagrotta landfill."
Paul's wet mouth worked the air for nearly half a minute.
"Do they know?"
"Yes, it's them. They'll turn up the heads eventually."
"Jesus."
His forehead sank to the dirty table and he muttered something indecipherable into his lap.
"Tell me what happened,"
said Sam. Paul raised his head, confused, as if the answer were obvious.
"I panicked."
"Where'd you get the gun?"
"I always have a spare,"
This one? Sam said as he reached into his jacket and took out the Beretta Natalia had given him. He placed it on the table in front of himself so that no one behind them could see it.
Jesus,
Paul repeated.
Are you going to use that?
You dropped it when you ran off. Natalia found it.
Right.
Take it back and get rid of it.
Paul hesitated, then reached out, knocking the wine bottle into a totter. He yanked the pistol into his stomach and held it under the table.
I unloaded it, Sam told him, so don't bother trying to shoot yourself.
The sweat on Paul's forehead collected and drained down his temple.
What's going to happen?
To you?
Sure, but all of it. The operation.
The operation's dead, Paul. I haven't decided about you yet.
I should get back to Geneva.
Yeah, you should probably do that, Sam said, and stood.
No, he wasn't going to kill Paul Fisher, at least not here. Not now. He left the bar and took a taxi to the Porta Pinciana and walked down narrow Via Sardinia past storefronts and cafes to the embassy. As he unloaded his change and keys and phone for the doorman, Randall Kircher came marching up the corridor.
Where the hell have you been, Sam?
Though there was panic in his case officer's voice, nothing was explained as they took the stairs up to his third-floor office. Inside, two unknown men, one wearing rubber gloves, stood around a cardboard box lined with plastic that folded out of the top. Though he knew better, Sam stepped forward and looked inside.
Sent with a fucking courier service,
muttered Randall. Sam's feet, his stomach, and then his eyes grew warm and bloated. Though the men in the room continued talking, all he could hear was the hum in his left ear, the residue of complete failure. No one saw him for 3 days. Randall Kircher was inundated by calls demanding Sam's whereabouts, in particular from the Italians who wanted an explanation for shots fired in a mosque. But he knew nothing. All he knew was that after seeing Saeed's severed head on Thursday, Sam had walked out of the embassy, leaving even his keys and cell phone with the embassy guards. The next day, the video appeared on the internet, routed through various servers around the globe. Lorenzo and Saeed on their knees. Behind them hung a black sheet with a bit of white Arabic, and then a hooded man with a ceremonial sword. And so on. Kircher didn't bother watching the entire thing, only asked Langley to please have their analysts do their magic on it. In reply, they asked for the report Sam hadn't filed. He told them it was on the way. On Saturday, 2 days after his disappearance, Kircher sent two men over to Sant'Onofrio, where Sam's debit card had been used on two cash machines, to take out about $1,000 worth of euros. They, however, found no sign of him. Then on Monday morning, as if the entire embassy hadn't been on alert to find him, he appeared at the gate a little after 8:30, dressed in an immaculate suit, and politely asked the guards if they still had the cell phone and keys he'd forgotten last week. Randall called him up to his office and waited for an explanation. All Sam gave him at first were oblique references to groundwork he'd been doing on a deal to provide inside intelligence on Somali pirates.
What?
Randall demanded, hardly believing this.
I got in touch with one of my Ansar sources. A member of Aslim Taslam was in town, and I approached him about selling us intel. I wasn't about to blow my cover by contacting the embassy before we'd met.
What was your cover?
Representing some businesses.
Sounds like the company to me.
Sam didn't seem to get the joke.
I talked to him yesterday. He's loaded with information.
How'd you verify this?
Sam blinked in reply.
And how much did you offer him?
€500,000.
Randall began to laugh. He wasn't being cruel, he just couldn't control himself.
$500,000 for a storyteller?
Sam finally settled into a chair and wiped at his nose. What followed was so quiet that Randall had to lean close to hear.
He's the one who cut off their heads.
The clouds parted and Randall could see it all now.
Absolutely not, Sam. You're taking a vacation.
His name is Nabil Abdullah Badun. Somali, Not a foot soldier, but one of the heads of Aslim Taslam. They're desperate for cash, and we can use it against him.
Against them?
Sam frowned.
Them, not him. We're not into vengeance here. We're not Mossad.
Then think of it this way, said Sam. We have a chance to decapitate the group before it gains momentum.
Decapitate?
Sam shrugged. Randall stifled a sigh.
Step back, once again from the top.
A bomb, Sam said without hesitation. In the bank computer. Nabil will want to be on hand to witness the transfer.
Here in Rome?
Sam hesitated.
Not settled. Probably not here.
Somalia?
Maybe.
You're going to take a bomb through customs?
I can have it made locally. I have the contacts.
Randall considered the loose outline, flicking over details one after the other. Then he ran into a wall.
Wait a minute. How does this bomb go off?
With the transfer code.
So who's going to perform the transfer?
Sam coughed into his hand.
Me.
Again?
I'll type in the code.
You're going to commit suicide?
Sam didn't answer.
May I ask why?
It's personal.
Personal?
Randall said, shouting despite himself.
I really should advise you to see the counselor.
You probably should.
Silence followed, and Randall found a pen on his desk to twirl.
It's ridiculous, Sam, and you know it. I know you're upset about what happened to Lorenzo and Saeed, but it wasn't your fault. Hell, it probably wasn't even that idiot Paul Fisher's fault. It just happened, and I'm not going to lose one of our best agents over this. You can see that, can't you?
Sam's face gave no sign either way.
Post-traumatic stress disorder, that's what's going on here, you know. It's a sickness.
Sam blinked slowly at him.
I won't insist on the therapist, not yet, but I am insisting on vacation. Aren't you supposed to go car racing next week?
Cross-country rally.
Good. Write up a report on the fiasco and then take 3 weeks.
Sam was already on his feet, nodding.
Keep safe, Randall told him, and do consider the therapist. Voluntarily. I'll not lose you.
But Sam was already out the door. There had been an unexpected storm along the south side of snow-capped Mount Kenya that morning, and so by noon he was soaked with mud, and by late afternoon it had dried to a crust, turning his clothes into a lizard skin of hard scales. But he went on. His empty passenger seat set him apart from most of the Europeans and Americans taking part in the rally, and when asked, he told them his partner had dropped out because of business obligations, an excuse they all understood. At the end of the day, they drank together in tents set up by their Kenyan hosts. The Italians were loud, the French condescending, the Brits sneering, the Americans annoyingly boisterous. A hive of multinational caricatures bound together by speed and beer, business and tall tales about women they'd had. These things were, he reflected, the lifeblood of Western masculinity. It was Friday, 2 days before the end of the race, when through his exhausted eyes and muddy goggles he saw Benjamin Mwoki standing among the t-shirted organizers, wearing a suit, one hand on his hip, and no expression on his face. In his other hand was a bottle of Tusker lager. Sam pulled up amid the other drivers' shouts and hoots, flipped up his goggles and nodded at Benjamin, who took the cue and wandered away from the camp. Sam checked his time, rinsed off and changed into shorts, a blue cotton button-up, and leather sandals from his waterproof bag. By then, Benjamin was a silhouette against a backdrop of fading mountains. Sam had to run to catch up with him.
Here,
Benjamin said, holding out his beer.
You need it more than I do.
They shared the bottle in silence, walking slowly, until Benjamin remembered and said,
You're nearly the last one in.
The rain does it to me.
I'll pray for clear skies.
The sun is even worse.
Having known each other for 3 years, the men used the exchange of pass phrases not to recognize each other, but to signal if one or the other was compromised.
But really,
said Benjamin,
Are you driving well?
I'm surviving.
It's a difficult course.
They paused and looked back at the bustling activity of the camp. Lights flickered on to hold back the encroaching dark. A dusty wind came at them, raising little tornadoes, then died down.
Did you receive the instructions? Sam asked.
I'm here, aren't I?
I mean the rest of it.
Yes.
And?
What would you like me to say? That I think it's dangerous? I've said that about too many of your plans to keep on with it.
But do you see any obvious flaws?
Just that you'll end up dead.
Sam didn't answer. He was too tired to lie convincingly. Benjamin looked into his face.
A life for a life? It's a lot to pay.
More than one life, we hope.
We,
Benjamin said quietly.
I had a talk with your fat attaché. I don't think he knows the first thing about this.
Sam felt his expression betraying too much.
You told him?
No, Sam, I felt around some. I'm good at that.
Good.
It's not on the books, is it?
It's above his clearance, Sam lied, but it was an easy lie. The computer finished?
By Monday.
I'll be back next Wednesday.
So I'll give it to you then?
Not me. You'll give it to someone else.
A light seemed to go on in Benjamin's always astute eyes.
Someone even more foolish than you?
I'll let you know. You'll give it to him, but you won't say a thing about it. You're a good enough liar for that, aren't you?
Benjamin's expression faltered.
This is a very stupid man.
A nervous man. Just give him the case. He knows what to do with it.
He knows he'll die?
You're full of questions, Benjamin. We're paying you well enough, aren't we?
You have always paid well, Sam.
On Monday, as he sat across from Paul Fisher in the Aéroport International de Genève, he wondered why he was pushing it so far. Was he pushing it too far? He hadn't seen Paul since that bar in Rome, and now that they were face to face again, the prospect of killing him here, now, seemed much more inviting. Easier. More wholesome. But he'd begun to fall in love with the balance of his plan. One bomb would take out not only the man indirectly responsible for Saeed's gruesome murder, but also the man who had worked the blade through the muscles and bone. Now it was just a matter of persuasion. So after the invention of the technology that would wash bank accounts clean, he assured Paul that he wouldn't be alone. Sam would be there, right by his side, to authorize the transfer with his index finger. That seemed to calm him. Then he told Paul what they both knew, that he wasn't cut out for this kind of work and never had been.
Consider this a chance to redeem yourself,
Sam said, and it felt as if, through lies, he had cut to a deeper truth than he ever could have come upon honestly. His love of the plan kept him moving forward even when, on Wednesday, Saeed's murderer told him his real name and the name of his employer. Sam had put too much work into the plan to let it fall apart now, so he improvised. He absorbed this discovery into his tale and even encouraged Nabil to murder Paul. He admitted the issue was personal. It was reckless, yes, but his sense of the rightness and beauty of his plan had made him delirious. Yet it was too late. He realized his mistake only when they plucked him off the street and drove him out of town to that finely appointed house. Even then, however, he clung to hope. They still wanted the money, and if necessary, he would type in the code himself. He would prefer it, if Paul were beside him, to accept the blast as well, but he would make do with what was possible. What he never expected was the politician sitting with a scotch in the living room, the fat one with the round eyes that stared in horror as he was dragged in. Their eyes met, but neither said a thing. Surprise kept them both mute. His captors dragged him to the basement and locked the door, and Sam settled at the table thinking through the implications of Daniel Kwambai working with Aslim Taslam. As if he'd read Sam's mind, some 10 minutes later, Kwambai opened the door and stepped inside wearing a wrinkled linen jacket, stretched on one side by something heavy in the pocket. He closed the door and stared at Sam.
What are you doing here?
Came his falsetto whisper.
You're playing both sides, Daniel, aren't you?
Kwambai shook his head and took a seat across from him.
Don't judge me, Sam. You're not in a position.
We don't pay you enough?
No one pays enough, you know that. But maybe after this money you're bringing I'll be able to quit playing any sides at all. If the money's legitimate.
Is it? Sure it is. Is the information going to be legitimate?
They don't tell me much, but no, I don't think so.
Sam feigned disappointment.
You going to help me out of here, then?
Not before the money's transferred.
And then?
Kwambai didn't answer. He seemed to be thinking of something, while Sam was thinking about the bulge in Kwambai's pocket.
Well?
I'm considering a lot of things, said Kwambai. For instance, how you would stand up to Nabil's interrogation.
No better or worse than most men, probably.
And I'm wondering what you'd say.
About you? Sam shook his head. I don't think you have to worry about that. If he doesn't follow that line of questioning, there'll be no reason to answer.
A sad smile crossed Kwambai's face.
And if he just asks for a reason to end the pain?
Sam knew what he was getting at, but things had become confused enough by this point that he couldn't be sure how he wanted to answer. The obvious thing to say was that he'd protect Kwambai's relationship with the company to his dying breath, but no one would believe that, least of all him. The truth was that he recognized that sad look on the politician's face. It was the same expression Kwambai had given just before accepting that initial deal a year ago to make contact with the Somali extremists who'd been doing business in Kenya. The look signaled that, while he could hardly admit it to himself, Kwambai had already made up his mind. So he repeated the lie he had used to encourage the coward Paul Fisher.
You still need me for the transfer.
He raised his hands and tickled the air with his fingers.
My prince.
But nothing changed in Kwambai's face.
Take it out, then, said Sam.
What?
The gun. Take it out and do what you have to do. I personally don't think you can. Not here in your own house. Not with your own hands. And how would you explain it to Nabil? He wants me. Like you, he wants the money. He...
Sam stopped himself because he recognized that he was rambling. Panic was starting to overcome him. Dutifully, though, Kwambai removed a revolver from his pocket and placed it on the table, pointing it at Sam much the way Sam had pointed the Beretta at Paul Fisher. Unlike the Beretta, this was an old gun, a World War II model Colt 45. Kwambai's eyes were red around the edges.
I like you, Sam. I really do.
But not that much.
No.
Kwambai said as he lifted the pistol and shot three times before he could think through what he was doing. Benjamin. Benjamin had lived most of his life making snap decisions and only afterward deciding whether or not they'd been correct. Intuition had been his primary guide. Even the occasional services he performed for the Americans and the Brits had begun that way. So all afternoon, as he tracked down a friend who would be willing to drive Paul Fisher to the border, he had wrestled with it, weighing Fisher's life against the comforts of his family. If the Americans cut him off, George would probably not get to football camp this year. Elena's confirmation party would be more modest than planned. And Murugi, his long-suffering yet intractable wife, would start questioning the shift in the monthly budget. Was one stranger's life worth it? It wasn't until the trip back to the hotel in his friend's Toyota pickup that he really convinced himself that he'd done right. We're all employed by someone, he told himself philosophically, but in the end it's self-employment that motivates us. The sentence charmed him, provoking a mysterious, proud smile on his lips, and that only made it more disappointing when he arrived at the hotel and learned that it had all been for nothing. His first clue was Chief Jafet Obure in the lobby, talking with the hotel manager and the bartender. The local police chief rolled his eyes at the sight of Benjamin.
Kidnapped American and then you appear, Ben. Why am I not surprised?
You know me, Jaffe. I can smell scandal a mile away.
Benjamin's disappointment was breathtakingly vast, bigger than he would have imagined. He hadn't known Paul Fisher. Had he liked him? Not really. He had liked Sam, but not the feeble man who affected coldness to overcome an obvious cowardice. And it wasn't as if Paul Fisher had been innocent. None of the connected Americans who wandered into his country were. But his disappearance hurt just the same.
Looks like he hadn't even unpacked,
Japhet said once they were both in his room. Benjamin, by the door, watched the chief touch the wrinkled bedspread and the dusty bedside table. But what the chief didn't notice was the empty space, just beside the luggage stand, where the briefcase had been. As Japhet opened closets and drawers, Benjamin watched over his shoulder, but the all-important case wasn't there. Why hadn't Benjamin taken it with him when he'd left? He knew the answer, but it was so banal as to be embarrassing. He, like anyone, didn't want to run around town carrying a bomb. Once everything had been brushed for prints, a long line of witnesses interviewed and darkness had fallen, Chief Obure invited him out for a drink. Benjamin called Murugi and told her he'd be late.
Because of the kidnapped American?
It was already making the news. By 9, he and Japhet were sitting at a sidewalk cafe drinking cold bottles of Tusker and eyeing a trio of 12-year-old boys across the road sucking on plastic bags of glue.
Breaks my heart to see that, said Japhet.
Then you should be dead 60 times over by now,
Benjamin answered as his cell phone rang a monotone sound. Simultaneously, Japhet's played a recent disco hit. A house northeast of the city, not so far from the United Nations compound in Runda Estate, had been demolished by an explosion. Benjamin knew the house, and back when Daniel Kwambai had still been in the government's favor, he'd even visited it. Still, the fact that the bomb had ended up in one of Kwambai's houses was a surprise.
Time for a field trip,
Japhet said when they'd both hung up. It took them 40 minutes to reach Runda Estate and head farther north, where they followed the tower of smoke down to the inferno on the hill. The firefighters had left to collect more water, and Peely, one of Benjamin's assistants, was standing in the long front yard staring at the flames. He was soaked through with sweat.
The explosion came from inside. That's what the fire chief says.
What else would they expect?
Asked Japhet. Since his boss didn't reply, Peely said,
Car bomb.
Right, right.
Both Peely and Japhet watched as Benjamin approached the burning house on his own. He stopped where the temperature rose dramatically, then began to perspire visibly, his shirt blackening down the center and spreading outward. From behind, he heard Japhet's voice.
What are you thinking, Ben?
Just that it's beautiful,
he answered, because that was true. Flames did not sit still. They buckled and wove and snapped and rose so that you could never hold their true form. Perhaps they had no true form. Wood popped and something deep inside the inferno exploded.
Do you know what's going on here, Ben?
The wailing fire truck was returning, full of water. Farther out, headlights moved down the long road toward them. That would be absolutely everyone. Government representatives, religious leaders, the Americans, the United Nations, the press. He took Japhet's arm and walked him toward his car.
Come on, I'll buy you a drink, whatever you like.
A rare and wonderful offer, Japhet said. You steal something?
I've earned every cent I have,
he answered, twirling keys around his finger.
I just feel like forgetting.
This?
If I forget it, maybe it'll just go away,
Benjamin said, smiling pleasantly as he got in and started the car. In no time at all, they had passed the incoming traffic and made it over the hills and back into the city. It was as if the burning house had never been. Despite the sweltering heat, Benjamin had even stopped sweating.